Ready to roll. You know, it'd be a shame to do an hour and then lose it and not get it. That, you know, that would be tragic.
Well, and in the case of the interview with me, why, it might be a blessing in disguise. You just never know.
I don't think so. I need to turn my old speakers off.
Anyway, to begin with, I apologize. I just absolutely totally lost track of time.
Yeah, I admire men who can do that. That can get so involved in something that he loses complete all focus of time. I've never been able to do that. That's tremendous power of concentration.
Well, it's a consulting project that I'm working on for a local account, and so I just got completely submerged in it.
I guess before we go any further, I should tell everybody who we are. I'm Phil Parr, and this is the fifth year of a program we call Blind Like Me, and our guest is Ron Milliman, and you are somewhere in Kentucky. Are you in Max's town?
I'm in Bowling Green, Kentucky, yeah.
Yeah, that's where he is, in Bowling Green.
Yeah.
And that's how we met this gentleman, through our friend Max Robinson, and I gather, without being told this, that you both taught at the same university.
Yeah, Max taught in a different area. He taught actually over in the physics department, and I teach marketing here at Western Kentucky University in the College of Business.
You still teach? You're still active?
Oh, yes, yeah. You know, I could retire any time I want, but to be perfectly honest about it, I don't know anything else I would rather do. I absolutely love my job. I love my students, and it's been a great match. I like the university a lot, and I've gotten along very well with the faculty, administration, and this is a wonderful job. You know, you get your breaks at holidays and breaks between semesters, and I haven't taught in the summer for several years now. So, gosh, there's just a lot of benefits, and
yeah,
I stay active in research and publishing and those sorts of things.
And why would a guy want to quit a job like that? I mean, why would
Well, that's right.
You know, why would you want to give up a job like that? I gather that you and Max are maybe not exactly the same age, but close in proximity to the same age.
Max is much, much, much older than I am. Yeah.
Yeah, he's about 6 months older than me.
No, yeah. Actually, Max is a little bit older than I, but I've known Max for, oh, goodness sakes, over 20 years now, something like that.
Yeah, my father-in-law says the same thing. He's a lawyer, and he says, well, you know, if I retired, I don't know what the hell else I'd do.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't play golf, and I don't hunt. So, you know,
well, I do a lot of things. I do a lot of other things, so it's not like, you know, I wouldn't have things to do, but it's just that I enjoy this job a lot, and it keeps me active, and to some extent, I think it keeps me young. After all, I work with these young people that are 20, 21, 22 years old on a regular basis, and I think it kind of keeps me plugged into that part of the world.
I think you're probably right, and you've taught there for how many years?
Yeah, I came on board here at Western in 1985, and I've been here ever since. I'm a full professor. I'm tenured, and you know, it really can't get much better than it is here.
22 years or so.
Yeah.
How did you lose your eyesight? Did you start out this way? Give us your history of when you were a youngster.
No, actually, I was born with perfect sight, and I had perfect vision until I was 8. And in the third grade, I contracted a very rare illness called Stevens-Johnson syndrome. And that left me partially sighted until I was 17. And through a rather bizarre wrestling accident, I lost what vision I had at that time, I lost. And until I was about 29, And then I had some somewhat miraculous surgery down in Houston for a doctor is pretty well known internationally, Louis J. Girard.
Uh-huh.
And Dr. Girard restored my vision, and I had extraordinary vision for about 3.5 years, but through a series of complications, I lost it again. So I've actually lost my sight twice, and the second time, in all honesty, was much more difficult than the first because I had been driving a car and doing everything. And,
yeah.
And then to come out of the hospital totally blind, totally and permanently blind, and giving up that sense of freedom that I had with being able to walk out and jump in the car and just go anywhere I wanted to at
yeah.
any time was it was difficult.
Now you say a wrestling accident. Somebody you got elbowed in the eye or someone?
That's exactly right. Yeah, mm-hmm. I was a varsity wrestler on the wrestling team at Michigan School for the Blind, and which by the way we had some outstanding teams up there. The Michigan School for the Blind took the state championship, I think, 2 or 3 years in a row in Michigan, and we had some outstanding wrestling teams up there. I was a varsity wrestler on that team and caught an elbow in the eye. It's just a completely freak accident, but it took care of the sight I had at that time.
And this was, I think you said, but this was at what age now?
I was 17.
But you knew then you were that at that time you expected to be a blind person all your life. I mean,
at that time I had my vision was up and down, and I was legally blind since age 8. So I didn't have any at that point. I had no expectations of ever regaining my vision.
And you lost it at that point in time almost completely from this freak wrestling accident. And, of course, as you said, that was traumatic. But then you were 17, Dan, and at what age did they do the operation in Houston that gave you
29.
Full...
Yeah, so I was blind.
Yeah.
I mean, with just a little bit of light perception for those 12 years.
So you had started an adult life as a blind person.
Oh, yeah, sure. I went to all the way through undergraduate school and at Eastern Michigan University and went on to graduate school at Arizona State University blind and traveled with a guide dog. I had two guide dogs through that period of time. And I had every expectation of being a blind person, sure.
And you weren't going to let that slow you down. You did college and then graduate school and were ready to... Had you found a job by then?
I graduated from Arizona State University with my Ph.D. In marketing with areas in economics and quantitative systems. And from Arizona State, I went out... and started teaching at the University of Texas system. My first position was the University of Texas at Arlington.
How much trouble did you have finding a college that was willing to train you? Did you have any?
No, I had no problem getting into Arizona State really at all. My grades coming out of Eastern Michigan I had a little over a 3.8 grade point average on a 4-point scale, so my grades were good. When I graduated from Eastern Michigan, I went out into the workforce and sold insurance, securities, and real estate for a while, and that was up in Michigan. And in your life you have certain major turning points. You look back and you see major turning points,
uh-huh.
And I'll never forget one day I had 8 appointments. This is when I was in the business up in Michigan, in Lansing, Michigan. I had an office up there. And one day I had 8 appointments, and all 8 stood me up. I mean, not one single appointment showed up that day. And it was late at night. I was hungry, and I hadn't eaten because I had appointments. I stayed up there for meet the appointments that never showed up.
Yeah.
And so I grabbed my guide dog, and her name was Holly. And I said, Holly, let's get the heck out of here and go home. And so we went downstairs, and I went to open up the door, and I had a hard time getting the door open. In fact, Holly, my dog, she laid down, and she'd never done that before. And And it was like she said, well, you go on, you go ahead. I'm fine where I am. And I realized it had snow had drifted against the door. It had been snowing all day.
And I had
quite a time getting out. And when I got out, I tugged on Holly and pulled her out through the door. And we proceeded. But I'm telling you, Phil, there was snow everywhere, fresh snow, and you couldn't tell where the sidewalk was. I mean, it was just incredible. The only way I got home at night is because I walked. It was a long distance from over to my house, and we were kind of wandering around, and this young fellow pulled up and rolled down his window, and he said, "Hey, do you need some help?" And I said, "Boy, I sure do." And so we climbed in front of that car. Phil, it was and of course, when I got in, at the time I didn't know what I was getting into for sure, but we climbed in, and it turned out to be a Volkswagen Bug. And I had my dog was a pretty good-sized German Shepherd, so getting her in the front of that Volkswagen and everything. But we went off, and he got me home that night. He was a young fellow from Michigan State University, and he got me home that night. And I went in and took my dog's harness off and sit on the couch. And I said, I told my wife, I said, we're just too damned young to put up with this for the rest of our life. I said, this is just not what we're going to do the rest of our lives. And that was a major turning point that day. And the next day I got on the phone and started calling her uncle. I kind of wanted to go back to graduate school anyway. Uh-huh. In fact, I was slated to go into the MBA program at Michigan State. So I just picked up the phone and started making calls around the country to find a different position somewhere else and find a graduate school. And we ended up at Arizona State. I had no problem getting into Arizona State at all. They were wonderful people to work with. They were very accommodating. Way back then, we're talking about 1977, 78.
Oh, okay.
And they were very accommodating. No, I'm not. I'm sorry. I'm ahead of myself. We're talking about 1967, 68.
That's what I was thinking. That would have been about the right age.
That's right. And so to think of that university being as accommodating as they were was incredible back then. But they were, and my professors were all very easy to get along with, and it worked out extremely well. And oh, sure, there were some struggles. Believe me,
I'm sure.
I struggled getting through a microeconomics class, I can tell you that. But,
struggled,
we made it.
Struggled because you didn't have the material, or you had it in Braille, I guess.
No, there was nothing at that level. Nothing was, it was in Braille or recorded at that level. You know, we're talking about graduate PhD level. Yeah. And so there was nothing pre-recorded. I had to get everything pre-recorded, which is, a job within itself. And as a matter of fact, the graduate students helped out. They volunteered to help me in terms of being readers.
Uh-huh.
And kind of another turning point in my graduate experience was, I was in a high-level stat class. And I knew the professor. I had taken a couple courses from him before and done really quite well in his classes. But the first exam came up, and he was giving it to me. He gave me the exams orally. And I was doing terrible. I mean, I was just absolutely just totally failing the exam. And he stopped. He stopped about halfway through, and he said, "Ron, what in the world is going on here?" He said, "This is not like you at all." He said, "What's happening? Something's wrong." And I said, "Well, to be honest with you, I haven't been able to get the book in any kind of accessible format at all, so I haven't been able to read the book, and I don't know what's going on." So I didn't know it at the time, but the next class session, Dr. Kashmir was his name, he came into the classroom and circulated a memo around. Again, I was sitting in there, but I didn't know what was happening. And the memo was asking for volunteers to help me in the course and to volunteer to read a chapter to me and help me with each chapter. And when he got done, he had every single student in that classroom volunteer to step up and read a chapter to me and help me. And Phil, after the first couple of sessions, it was so successful, the others went back and told the other members of the class that they were getting a great deal out of it, because if there's something I didn't understand, they would explain it to me and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So it worked out so well that, I kid you not, we actually got a big room over in the library, and you'd think it was a first-grade reading class. We had a big round table, and the whole class sat around that table, and they took turns going around the table reading parts of the chapters and discussing them. And we turned that class into like a group project, and everybody got a great deal out of it, and everybody in the class ended up with an A.
Well, you were very lucky in that you found that person willing to help, because we've done interviews with people who the college said, no, you can't, you get a degree in something else, but you can't get a degree in physics, or you can't get a degree in this or that.
Yeah.
So fate was with you. Now, this decision you made after tramping home through the snow and riding in the Volkswagen, that was, I don't want to live up here where it's freezing to death the rest of my life.
That's right. Yeah, no, it was just the snow and the ice, and gee whiz, I was, what, 22, 23 years old, and had my whole life ahead of me, and even though I was doing really quite well in the business at that time, I made MDRT my first year, which is $1 million round table. That doesn't mean I personally made $1 million. It means I sold $1 million
worth of
insurance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I was doing really quite well, but it just, you know, when you look ahead, your whole life ahead of you, and of course, that day where I had 8 stand-ups, I just said, no, this isn't for me, and so it was time for a change. You know, Phil, you know yourself, you can have all the money in the world, but money itself doesn't make you happy. You've got to be happy with what you're doing, and I just wasn't happy with what I was doing.
Be happy with yourself.
That's absolutely right.
You have to have some self-confidence.
Just like this job I'm in now.
Yeah.
I get paid quite well. But the point is, it's not the money. Now, I wouldn't want the university to know this, but I probably do the same thing for half the money because I enjoy the job so much.
Maybe they won't hear this, Ron. Hopefully, we won't mention that. I've got something on you now, boy. Listen, how did you get from your college degree into? I don't think I've ever maybe talked to one other blind person who was an insurance salesman, because you would have a lot of sales. Is eye contact, and of course you didn't have any, so you had to go by other indications that this person is ready to buy if I say this. How'd you get into insurance sales after college?
Yeah, actually that wasn't too difficult. I interviewed several firms, and of course my grades were good, and evidently I came across fairly well, fairly competent, and so I had several offers. I don't know how many. I think maybe 3 or 4 offers from different firms to go to work for them. And
your degree was in marketing.
Yeah, I was a triple major in undergraduate school. I was sociology, psychology, and business. And I don't know if that helped me any or not, but it didn't. I'm sure it didn't hurt me. But I really didn't find it that difficult. I'd always been a promoter of sorts. I always enjoyed business. I had always enjoyed sales. Been involved in sales and various kinds of things before then, and enjoy working with people, and got along fairly well with people, and could read people, you know, pretty well from their voice inflections and that sort of thing. So I really didn't find it that difficult. I've learned from my experience that in the case of insurance, why when I did the choice close, I'd say, well, to begin with, you want to start with the $15,000 or the $20,000 program, and of course, you know, they'd always want to start with the lower one. But I learned really quickly that if I made the choice, you want to start with $100,000 or the $75,000 program, they'd pick the $75,000, but that's okay, because I was about 8 times more than I started out with to begin with. So
yeah, but a lot of times if you don't offer them a choice, then they don't know about the cheaper one.
Yeah.
I'm sure. But and so you did this for gotten out of college. So you did this for a couple of years.
Yeah, a couple of years. But I learned quite quickly in the insurance industry that that a lot of people needed the insurance, but they didn't really want it, of course, which is nothing surprising there. But a lot of them, they really wanted, they needed the insurance, but they wanted more of an investment. And I don't want to discourage anybody from getting insurance, but in terms of insurance, your best deal is term insurance, and whole life insurance is not, I mean, it's a forced savings program. It's not a particularly good investment. And so if one's looking for an investment, what you do is you get your insurance through a term insurance, and you take the difference and invest in mutual funds or something like that.
Yeah,
and
well,
so that's what I started doing. I started selling a lot of term insurance and taking the difference and investing, helping people to invest in a portfolio of stocks and bonds and particularly in mutual funds. And the insurance company did not like me to do that, but
I did. Well, of course, after yesterday's experience with the stock market, I don't know if I'd advise folks to put their money in mutual funds or not.
That's the nature of the market.
It is.
And you know yourself, Phil, if you put dollars in stocks, particularly well selected mutual funds, and don't worry about it in that day to day up and down, but just you do a really good job of selecting and sitting back, and you sort of tweak it every year or two or something like that. In the long run, you're better off.
Oh, you are. It's the best way to actually. I mean, you can put it in a CD and earn 2%.
Yeah.
Or something like that. But, the stock market is the best way. But it sure scares you when you come in a day and you realize your portfolio, my God, we lost $8,000 yesterday.
That's the reason why you don't want to get hung up in the day-to-day up and down. Unless that's your profession. I mean, there's some people that's their business. But they're professionals, and that's what they're
in business to do. But it'll scare you to death. If you do the day-to-day, it can scare you.
Sure.
Okay,
absolutely.
So from Michigan, you went to Arizona State and began graduate school with long-term thinking. Your degree now was it? I know you've told us, but your degree ended up being in what now again?
Well, I picked up the MBA degree, and then from there I went into the PhD program with a degree in marketing with areas in economics and quantitative systems.
And you did 3 years there at Arizona State.
Well, actually more than that. I started at Arizona State, in 1968, I guess.
Okay.
My degree, officially my degree, my PhD was in 1974. I left in 73, what we call ABD, all but dissertation. I had all my coursework done, and my dissertation was substantial work on my dissertation, but I left before I got that completed to accept a position at the University of Texas, Arlington. And I finished up my doctoral dissertation after I got to Arlington.
Is that right? And they had already hired you at the University of Texas at Arlington?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Man, that's... they didn't say, how's a blind guy going to do this or that? What was that like? Did they...
Well, as a matter of fact, I got some of that. Not so much from Arlington, but when I interviewed... I interviewed several schools, and... I did get questions like, how are you going to keep up in a profession? And a very important part of being a professor is doing quality research. And how are you going to conduct research and get articles published and that sort of thing? My answer is, I've gotten this far. You don't get the doctoral, you don't get a doctorate degree without being able to handle those kinds of things. And I use readers and a combination of different things. Of course, back then we didn't have nearly the technology we got today. Today it's, I won't say it's easy, but I'll tell you what, it's a lot easier today than it was then.
Oh, my heavens, it'd be a lot easier even a kid in college, lugging a big old 30-pound Webcore tape recorder around to readers.
Oh,
now,
goodness.
Now you carry something in your pocket.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just no comparison at all.
But then with the Internet, doing research is a breeze now.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. So, and in my case, of course, I had readers, and we went over. I remember spending hours and hours and hours in the stacks in the library, you know, doing research and having readers read stuff to me and taking all notes in Braille. And my doctoral dissertation, I don't remember how many Braille pages it ended up to be, but it was... it was substantial, believe me.
But you did this dissertation after you had this job at the University of Arlington.
I finished it after that. Actually, I should have been done before, but I was in a car accident. When I was working my dissertation, I had all my coursework done at Arizona State, and mm-hmm. I was in a car accident. That set me back. It set me back at least a year. I would have completed my dissertation on time and gone out from Arizona State to Arlington with degree in hand if it hadn't been for that car accident. That set me back several months.
Which injured you physically some, this car accident?
Yeah, actually, believe it or not, I had some substantial head injuries, and there's some real concerns about that because, as I tell everybody, my biggest asset's my brain, and because I'm not, you know, I'm short, fat, and ugly, and the only thing that works really, really well on me is my brain.
I love it. And so this car accident, but then you're married at this time. Did you and your wife try to start a family, or did you stay together, or what?
Well, we stayed together, and at least at that point we did, and we had... when I was going to Arizona State, we had two boys, and so, yeah, I had started a family and lived really what I would consider a very normal life because my colleagues in the doctoral program, many of them were married and had children, and so I didn't think of myself being too much different from anybody else in that regard.
But you were at that time totally blind.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, sure. Yeah.
All right. So we have you at Arlington, the University of Texas at Arlington. You've got your degrees. And how did you get to the operation in Houston? How did all that come up?
Yeah, actually, that's the interesting. It was a doctor, an eye doctor that my wife went to because she was also visually challenged, and we thought her vision could maybe be improved to the point where maybe she could drive, and we went to an eye doctor with the intent of getting her vision improved, which they did, by the way. They were able to improve it, and she was able to drive a car. In fact, she drives to this day. But in the process, while the doctor was sort of interested in me and my situation, and he took a look at me, and he said, "Well, you know, I'm aware of a doctor in Houston, Louis J. Gerard, that I believe could help you." And he's the one that referred me to Dr. Gerard down in Houston. That's how I ended up down there. And I didn't realize at the time how experimental the surgery was. I'm not going to say I wouldn't have done it in hindsight, but it was pretty experimental.
Well, but what did you have to lose? Nothing. I mean, you're blind already. What's the difference?
Well, what you have to lose, in a sense, is by waiting, maybe they would come up with something better, different, or maybe it wouldn't be quite as experimental as it was when I did. I was pretty much a guinea pig, to be blunt about it. And again, I'm not saying I regret having done what I did. It was a wonderful nearly 4 years that I had of incredibly good eyesight. Matter of fact, at my peak, after that surgery, I actually had what would be classified as 20/10 vision. In other words, I could see at 20 feet what a normal person would have to get within 10 feet of the eye chart to be able to see.
Really?
I was seeing things on the eye chart that the doctor had to get, and the nurse had to get closer to determine whether I was right or not.
And so you went for this surgery. Now, what sort of, was it retina, what was it, or do you know?
It used a, for lack of a better term, a plastic implant that replaced basically the front portion, the working portion of my eye, the cornea and lens. And because the back part of my eye, the optic nerve and retina was intact, it was fine. So it was just the scarring on the front of my eye that was keeping me from being able to see. So this plastic implant was used to replace the cornea and lens part of my eye.
But now you had already, as younger, you had had some sight, so they didn't have to tell you. Of course, you know, we discussed this with this fellow Mike May out in California, who has gotten his sight back, who never saw anything. They had to tell him, if you look at something, they had to say, Mike, this is a table.
Yeah.
And he had to factor into his brain, remember next time he saw that's
right.
A table. They didn't have to do that for you because you
already... No, that's a totally different situation. In my case, I had perfect sight until I was 8. And so I had all those fundamentals. I knew how to read print. I knew what everything looked like in that sense. But having said that, I can tell you that there was still a lot of relearning that had to take place. And I say relearning, I think really in kind of a layman's terms, it was like reconnecting the wiring in my brain.
Uh-huh.
Because I remember sitting in the waiting room there in the hospital when I was being discharged after the surgery. My mother was sitting next to me, and there's a big plate glass window there next to us. And she said, "Do you see all those cars out there?" Well, I looked out the window, and Phil, I didn't see any cars until there was some movement. And then that movement caught my attention. I was able to focus in. And it's like a light turned on or a switch was flipped. I realized that movement was a car. And as soon as my brain, it's like it just instantaneously reconnected.
Uh-huh.
And then all of a sudden I realized there were a whole parking lot full of cars out there. So I had some experiences like that. In fact, I had a couple that were even a little bit on the dangerous side even after I was driving car.
That's just, you know, strange to us who've never seen. Tell us about the dangerous ones. Why not?
Well, I was driving a car. I went out and I was, of course, able to drive past the driver's test, and I bought a little butterscotch-colored Datsun. It was called a Datsun at that time. Now it's a Nissan. And I was driving down the road, and I almost went right over top of some barriers. You know, there's like these big old sawhorses they put out across the road, you know, when they're doing road construction.
Yeah, to keep you from going that way.
Keep from you going that way. And I just, my brain just didn't connect that's what was there. And all of a sudden, I got fairly close to them, and all of a sudden, it was like, again, like a switch kicked on, and I realized that's what it was. And I, you know, of course, hit the brakes and went around them and didn't go through it, but I had a few experiences like it. In all honesty, I probably started driving before I should have. I was so excited about getting my sight back and so anxious to be able to do everything I was doing that I probably got my license a little bit quicker than I should have.
The world had to look its best at that point in your life. You're 30 years old, and you had to be. That has to be the most optimistic period of time ever. I mean, what a thrill! What a life-altering thrill it would be. You know, if I got my sight back tomorrow, I wouldn't. And this was virtually the same thing. You had been blind, and all of a sudden, Ron can see. Go to the grocery store. Go out. Get his car. He can do, you know, he wants to do anything he wants to do, because face it, blindness denies you quite a bit. I mean, especially children, you don't have that freedom, and you never will have it. I'm used to it because I've fought it all my life, but to suddenly have it, boy, would just be wonderful.
Well, it was quite an experience. A lot of things that was interesting, and that's, you know, when you're blind, you hear about what things look like, and you hear about changes that are going on. But when I got my sight back, I could see what people were talking about, and there were some real shocks. For instance, when I was young, up until I was 8, when I was young, men basically wore fairly muted colors. I mean, you know, men did not wear flashy colors. They wore the dark, you know, grays and browns and that kind of thing in general. But after I got my sight back, frankly, men dressed like peacocks to me. I mean, I'm telling you, the bright colors, it was unbelievable. I said, my goodness sakes, what is going on? And then I looked at my own wardrobe and realized I was dressing like that, too. Because my wife, had, you know, she had helped me buy the clothes and everything. And, so it's one thing to hear about it, something else to see it. And, of course, it was... Mini skirts were in vogue at that point. It was the tail end of the hippie era, and so some of that was still going on, and it was a really quite an era of our history. And men were wearing long hair. I remember going out to the mall, sitting and just watching people because I was so fascinated. I was trying to figure out which were the men and which were the women at that point. You know?
Did you do any writing then? Did you chronicle this in any way? These experiences in any way? Because I don't know that I ever talked to anyone. I talked to Mike, who had been blind all his life and got his sight back. But I don't think, if I remember correctly, I don't know if Mike had ever seen. Had ever been able to see. Maybe he had. But this, what an experience to have. I guess you didn't, because you were young and didn't think about it, did you?
Well, I didn't chronicle, and I didn't write it down. I probably should have. Of course, I have all these memories I share with people. But and there were a number of things. For an example, to give you another, it's really kind of a funny story. After I got my vision back, I went to the university for the first time. It's the first time I was going back to the campus after getting my sight back. And I went up the stairs and went down the hall and went to the elevator, got in the elevator and reached over and pressed the button for the fifth floor where my office was. And all this was new to me because I'd never seen any of this stuff before. When I was young, I saw an elevator, but I didn't see any of the University of Texas at Arlington stuff before.
Yeah.
And so I got in, and just like everybody, you know, everybody turns around and faces the front of the elevator there. And in this low, gruff voice, I won't repeat exactly what he said because I don't know what kind of audience you've got here. But he said, basically... What in the heck's wrong with you, Milliman? Can't you speak to your best friend? Now, he didn't say it quite that way. He colored it up a little bit, you understand, but that's basically what he said. And I turned around, and Phil, there was this guy that looked like an absolute total bum behind me, and... Yeah, it was Jerry Terranova, and I don't mind mentioning Jerry's name. He might even get back to him, but he'd laugh at it.
Yeah.
But Jerry was my best friend back then. He was a former student of mine, and I'd palled around with Jerry, and we'd gone out to Pizza Inn, have pizza and beer and all that sort of thing together on occasions, And when I turned around, I'll tell you, I would never recognize him in a million years. He had a scraggly beard. His hair looked like rats had slept in him. He had a dirty T-shirt on. His jeans had a hole in one knee of his jeans. He had tennis shoes on that were dirty. One of his tennis shoes was ripped. And I'm telling you, to think that I had been out with this guy walking the streets with him.
Well, was he aware of the fact that you could now see or not?
Oh, yeah. He knew that. Of course, word got around, you know, that I had had my surgery and everything. And he just waited. I mean, he saw me get on the elevator. He just, waited for me to turn around to see if what I was going to say. And it really, I had a number of funny experiences like that. Of course, I mean, that didn't make any difference. Jerry and I were always friends after that. I mean, that didn't affect me. But you get the idea. There were a lot of people that looked a lot different than what I thought they would.
But now, normally, if you had been blind 6 months before this, when you were blind, when you both got on the elevator, Jerry would have said something to you because he would have known you couldn't see him.
Oh yeah, but yeah, yeah. Oh, you know, sure. Yeah, he would have said something, but everybody was just kind of wondering what I was going to be like, if I was going to be a changed person, what the impact it was going to have on me, and so it was some interesting experiences.
So you taught classes one day as a blind person, and a month later you came back and taught the same students as a sighted person.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was really quite an experience too. Because my teaching style is a little bit different between being blind and sighted. As a blind professor, I don't use the chalkboard very much. I do some, but not very much. I use, of course, now today I use a computer all the time. But back then, I used a lot of, as a blind professor, instead of putting things on the board, I prepared things in advance and used them as handouts.
Uh-huh.
And we'd go over handouts and things like that. So my teaching style changed a little bit.
Now, your wife that you were married to at this time, you had two children, mm-hmm. and she got her sight back about the same time or later? Or
a little bit earlier. Yeah, she got her vision back before I did. I say back. Now, she had really pretty good sight. She really had good sight. She was legally blind, but it was right on the borderline.
Before the operation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then she didn't actually have surgery. She got her sight improved through glasses, a combination of glasses and contact lenses.
But there was a time, when both of you could drive and family life was really normal then?
Yeah, very much so.
Oh,
yeah.
Man, what a deal.
Yeah.
Here's Ron driving, his wife drives, and boy, things are just looking wonderful. Now, before we run out of time, and we're not even close, but I want to get to this, then something happened. You began to lose your sight. You can gradually tell us the story of the loss again of sight.
Well, yeah, I went through a series of numerous surgeries. Somewhat minor surgeries, but surgeries to try to maintain. Once I got it back, it was quite a job to maintain it. Because my system, my eye wanted to reject that foreign object that was in there. And so I ran into a number of complications. And finally, I developed glaucoma and some other problems. And I went into the hospital to get some of those things fixed, and there were complications in surgery, and the long and short of it is I ended up with a detached retina, and I ended up losing my sight totally and permanently. So I went in, I had some vision. In fact, I had pretty good vision when I went in, but when I came out, I had no vision at all. That was losing my sight the second time was a very, very difficult time.
In fact,
in hindsight, I realized it was even more difficult than what I was aware of at the time. It very much affected me emotionally, affected my marriage, affected my job. I ended up not getting tenure at the University of Texas, Arlington. For a variety of reasons, mostly because I frankly had not published sufficiently because I was too busy trying to maintain my sight.
Uh-huh.
But it affected me emotionally. I ended up in a divorce, and I have no ill feelings about my first wife at all. Now in hindsight, I fully understand what happened, but I certainly didn't understand at the time.
Yeah.
And so it was an extremely difficult period for me at that point. I lost my job, lost my eyesight. I was having problems with my marriage, and so I got another job, and I didn't have that much trouble getting another job. Amazingly, I got another job teaching University of Texas at El Paso.
But I know that you wondered after you got out of the hospital, you walked out, you thought, why in the hell did I go to the hospital? Why did I bother? You know, why did I go?
Yeah.
I felt great when I went, and now I don't.
Yeah, but I really didn't have a lot of choice because the complications were going to get me probably anyway. So it's one of those things that, you know, and besides, you rely on the doctor. If the doctor says that's what you have to do, and, you know, you put your faith in the doctor. So
You have no choice but to put your faith in the doctor.
Yeah,
and so you sold the car, and you realize that I'm blind, and I'm probably going to be this way the rest of my life. That's got to be just extremely traumatic. But
it was.
You dealt with it. You didn't commit suicide. You didn't jump off a cliff. You didn't. Your marriage broke up. And you lost your job, but like you said, you found another. Life continued, whether you wanted it to or not.
Well, that's right. it was very difficult to get rid of that. By the way, that butterscotch Datsun I had, I'll never forget. You know, selling that car, that was a very difficult thing to get rid of. But nevertheless, I did, and you're right. I moved on, got another position, University of Texas at El Paso, and kind of started over again at that point.
at the University of Texas at El Paso. Okay.
Yeah.
And you, but you were now totally blind.
Yeah.
And dealing back teaching as a totally blind person. What year? We're up to the mid 70s now, right?
Yeah. This is about 77,
okay.
76, 77, when this these things were taking place, yeah.
So we don't have computers yet, but...
No. Mm-mm.
No, we're far from that. So El Paso would not be, as far as I'm concerned, even if you hated Michigan, El Paso would be a tough... I'd hate to live in El Paso. I wouldn't care for
it. Well, it's sort of like moving to a foreign country,
yeah.
To be blunt about it. El Paso's right on the border there with Mexico. A substantial proportion of the population is Hispanic, and I didn't know how to speak Spanish. But, I took the position there at UT El Paso, and... I met my current wife. I met in El Paso, and we hit it off extremely well. I found her irresistible, and we got married not too long after I got out there. And I got my research back on target, and. The only thing is, to be honest, there was some political issues at the University of Texas, El Paso. I probably shouldn't go into the details of, but it involves some political things, some ethical things, and I was told to do some things that I deemed unethical, to be blunt about it.
Really?
It involves a major sports figure. I was basically told to give him a grade
that you
didn't earn,
and you wouldn't do it.
I refused to give it, and so I was told that I probably need to be looking for a different position.
Wow.
And, there's a lot of detail to that. I better probably just skip over. But
yeah.
At any rate,
what a thing! That's amazing that would happen. But it did.
Yeah, but it did. Yeah. It was a major sports figure, and he wasn't supposed to. After he got the grade he was supposed to get in my class, he was not supposed to be able to start as a starter. And because I gave him the grade that he deserved, that he earned. I mean, you know, that's just the way I am. And next thing I knew, he was in the starting lineup, and I checked the office. I found out his grade had been changed.
And it was time to move on, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was. And so I got looking around, a position opened at University of at Loyola University in New Orleans, chair of the marketing department over there, and I applied for it. I really, at the time I applied, I didn't think I would get it, to be truthful with you, but gosh, they got back in touch with me and said they were really impressed with my record, flew me out there, and I went through the interviewing process, and the next thing I knew, they were making me an offer. As a matter of fact, they offered me almost double the money I was making at the University of Texas.
Now, as a chair of the marketing department, that's... How many other professors were there in marketing then?
Gosh, you know, I don't remember, and that's I'm not hedging. I don't remember.
Quite a few, ten.
Well, no, there were just a few. I think there were five of us, but because Loyola is a fairly small school.
This is in New Orleans.
Yeah, New Orleans. It's a Jesuit institution.
How did they feel about a blind fella coming in as chair of the department over sighted people who had been there longer?
Seem to be a problem. It's really interesting, but by and large, I have not had a real serious problem along those lines because, to a large extent, my record spoke for itself. I was doing fairly well. Now, don't misunderstand. I can give you some examples of some very serious discrimination I ran into. And I'll share an example
with you
here in a minute.
All right.
But at Loyola, I was very well received, and they made me an outstanding offer. What helped me at Loyola, to be honest, is that the head of the math department, Bob McLean, Dr. McLean was the head of the math department over there at that time and had a very good record, was highly respected on campus. And so that helped me. They figured that, given the sakes, if a blind guy could get a PhD in mathematics and head the math department, then a blind guy could certainly head the marketing area.
Now, Dr. McLean, and he was there when you came, so there
yeah,
he had one.
Yeah,
blind...
he'd been on the faculty at Loyola University for really quite some time.
Where is he still alive?
No, I don't know. He passed away several years ago.
So they were amenable to blind. They knew about blind. They'd had blind people experience with blind people before.
Yeah. That really helped me. I'm not going to mislead anybody. That helped me tremendously. There's just no doubt about that.
What a wonderful thing! We have a school here that has two blind people as both as heads of departments. That's a hell of a thing. I mean, really.
And I doubt if that's ever happened before or since.
I would imagine not.
Yeah.
So how long did you stay there in New Orleans?
I stayed there until 1985. The reason why I changed is because they consolidated the College of Business. They were under some financial constraints, and they consolidated the College of Business, and they combined the marketing and management departments. And when they did that, I was sort of low man on the totem pole. The management head of the management area had seniority over me, and so my job in that sense was eliminated. And we had a 12-year-old daughter by that time. My second wife, Palma, and I had a 12-year-old daughter, and. The prospect of bringing a young lady up in the New Orleans area was not a very good prospect.
Okay, I got your point.
And
now, this new wife you have, is she fully sighted? Can she see?
Yes.
You?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Drives a car. Yeah. That's.
And so it was we perceived it really as an opportunity to take advantage of, to get out of New Orleans and to look around and see if we can find a better place to bring our daughter up in anyway. So then we started interviewing. That's how I ended up here at Western. But I went through a lot of interviews. I interviewed schools on the West Coast and in Florida and in Virginia. I interviewed a lot of schools. And I ran into quite a bit of discrimination at that point, more than I had previously. For an example, there was a university out in California, and you think of California being very progressive, but I ran into more discrimination in California than probably any other place I interviewed. But there's a school out there, a university that I sent my resume out to. And I did not put on my resume that I was blind. I didn't see any reason to do that. My record spoke for itself.
Uh-huh. You were already head of the department.
Yeah, and so there wasn't any point in flagging I was blind at that point. So, and they got back in touch with me, said, we got your resume. We really like the looks of your record. We're extremely interested. And so we set up a date for the interview. And flight arrangements, they were flying me out there and everything. And I told them before I left to go out there, I said, well, I probably need to tell you that I'm totally blind. I didn't want to shock them too much as I walked off the plane.
Yeah.
And the lady that was head of the search committee, her voice dropped about two octaves, and she said, Oh my goodness. I mean, I thought she was going to just totally lose it.
Faint or something.
Yeah. Right? And she said, I don't know what the search committee will do when they find this out. And so she hung up. She said, I'm going to take this up with the search committee. She hung up the phone. And she called me back later and reneged on the invitation.
Yeah, yeah.
And I told her, I said, well, you're in violation of the law, and you're discriminating against me purely on the basis of my being blind. And I said, that's against the law. You can't do that. So anyway, long and short of it is that she hung up the phone again, said she'd have to take that up with the committee. And she called me back that evening and said, well, the committee had reconsidered and that they would honor their invitation. But
they weren't going to hire you.
But I knew what I knew what was going to happen.
Yeah.
So we flew out there.
But why?
And ordinarily, let me tell you this. Ordinarily, it's customary in these situations for the university to have, and usually the head of the search committee, to meet you at the airport. And I'm not talking about blind people. I'm talking about it's as customary in our profession. They meet you at the airport.
Yeah.
They pick you up. They take you over to your to a hotel to make sure you're all set in your room and everything. Everything's okay in the hotel.
And your question, this didn't happen.
And then they usually pick you up that night, take you out to dinner. They wine and dine you to some extent.
But they
next
didn't.
Day, you know, yeah. interviews and so forth.
Yeah.
But that none of that happened. They did not meet me at the airport.
Right.
They did not. I had to get over to the hotel. I had to get to the campus myself. That was a terrible, terrible experience.
Well, like it or not, sir, we've killed an hour.
Oh, is that right?
That's amazing, isn't it? We'll let you get back to whatever this project that is so intriguing that that you concentrated on so heavily. Ron Milliman.
Well, let me tell you this closing, though, that Western Kentucky University has been a perfect marriage. I've been extremely successful. I've widely published. My articles are recognized internationally. And it's been a tremendous success story up here.
Thanks, Ron. We appreciate you. Ron Milliman from Bowling Green, Kentucky.
Thank you.
All right. Ron Milliman, professor, a tenured professor at Western Kentucky University. What a thing. Sounds like he's had a most interesting and most fulfilling and full life. Let me mention, of course, we always need guests. We do. We do about 80 shows a year between the Blind Handyman and Blind Like Me. And we need guests for every show. So if you can be a guest, we would appreciate that. We don't need people who've done amazing things. We just need people who are successfully dealing with blindness on a daily basis, like I am, like you are. So you need to come and be a guest on the Blind Like Me show. Of course, handyman, we need folks who do a little handyman work around the house or have built something. But anyway, if you can recommend a guest, if you want to could be a guest, we'd appreciate either way. My phone number is 936-634-9500. I have a couple of email addresses. Phil Parr, all one word, P-H-I-L-P-A-R-R, at consolidated.net, and phil@philparr.net. phil@philparr.net or philparr@consolidated.net. Either one will work. Come be a guest and help us do the show. We don't get paid for doing this. It's a labor of love, and so you come and do the same thing if you can. Thank you much for listening. We'll see you next week on Blind Like Me. Bye-bye.